Okay, you got Rag Radio right here. I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is KOOP, Hornsby, Austin. Today my guests are Tim Mahoney and Richard Whitaker. And our topic, the economy. It's the economy and why are we so stupid? Which is just a silly little way to put it together. But we're going to talk about how people in this country relate to economics, relate to what's going on in the world, how maybe insulated and isolated we are from the rest of the world in the way we view things. We're facing a lot of we're major crises on a number of different levels in economics, in our economy, and we don't know how to relate to them. We don't even know the terms. We don't even know how to address them. So, gentlemen, first, well, let me just say who these guys are. Tim Mahoney is a trustee at Austin Community College, has been watching Texas politics since the mid-70s, is also and has been an award-winning journalist, used to write for the Texas Observer. Richard Whitaker is a journalist, is a reporter on Texas politics and education for the Austin Chronicle, and is from Yorkshire to the north of England, or in the north of England. So, gentlemen, and you will know that when you hear him, too.
What's the giveaway? Is it the accent by any chance?
Yeah, I have a universal American accent, so there you go.
So we have the continental approach and the insulated, isolated American here. Guys, why don't we understand what's going on in the world around us in this country, and why can't we get a grasp on what's happening in our economy? And I guess the larger question is it even possible to understand it? Has the world economy gotten so complex? Is it a crapshoot trying to even get a handle on it at all?
Well, I think it's why we wanted to have this conversation is to try to empower the individual. And, you know, if you're hearing this, somebody that's talking to you about the advantages of globalization, they don't care about you. And you ought to go ahead and be able to immediately pigeonhole them as someone who is contrary to your interests. I think that's what motivated me for this dialogue.
Whereas I think my thought on what people need to do, first of all, you have to understand that international finance and economics is, like you said, it's so ridiculously complicated that, frankly, it's impossible to actually understand the whole thing. And part of the problem, I think, is that people think there's some great conspiracy where somebody sat in the back room going, well, if I pull this lever, then this will happen. What you have, actually, is a lot of people running around saying, you know, do not look at the man behind the curtain. And the man behind the curtain is pulling levers, hoping that one of them works. You know, the system is incredibly complicated.
Well, I think that's, you know, for American, the American experiment going back to the Revolution was, if you can't understand what somebody is saying, it's because they don't know what they're talking about.
Is it kind of like Windows, like Microsoft? I mean, it's patchwork. You do one thing and then you do something else to try to fix what you just did.
Well,
I think that really there's been kind of an unconscious loss of hope among Americans. You know, here in Austin, 30 years ago, people were turning out at the rate of 50% for local elections, and the last election was about 10%. And those are behaviors that we collectively share. People have left the common good, the common welfare. And right now, we were talking about before the show that we're seeing things unfold where the people who brought us into this mess are trying desperately to maintain the semblance of what they used to have. And so I think we believe that that's going to fail. And how are we going to be able to take control of our lives in that failure?
And I think there's a very interesting thing in Texas, which is constant elections on tax rates. And it's a very clever thing to do because it means that people think that they are in some way in charge of the financial future of the state, of whatever elected body or local government body that they're actually voting on this tax rate for. It doesn't necessarily mean they are. You can vote on the tax rate, but when, for example, when AISD tried to put through a tax increase last year, the number of people who wrote to us and said, this means my tax bill is going to go up by $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 a year.
And by us, you mean at the Austin Chronicle.
At the Austin Chronicle. And we have people terrified that their bill would just go through the roof. And he said, well, no, you have to move the decimal place across 2 points. And the way it's set up is so confusing, but looks like you're informed. And that's almost more dangerous than people not knowing anything. Not knowing what's really going on and thinking you do. That takes you in a very, very dangerous place. And I think that's a more important underlying issue than anything else we can really talk about.
Well, that reminds me a little bit of, for instance, comprehensive planning is a new buzzword here in Central Texas. And I think most of them are not going to turn out well because the central authorities want to maintain their hold on power, whatever that is. And so they kind of dabble out with the community. And they do little dog and pony shows kind of things. So Austin Community College has their planning effort in a set time frame, and it's grounded with board-appointed campus advisory committee. So there's more of a geographic decentralization in that. And I think that where something could be, a comprehensive planning process could be empowering for community, if you're not using that to really create and empower community, it will not last beyond the coming year, the coming financial chaos.
And I think another aspect of that, which is very problematical for any kind of planning or any kind of reasoned debate, is that when you talk about economics and you throw terms around like free market or deregulation or tort reform or socialism or whatever term wants to be thrown around, in America the response is very, very visceral to issues where the response should probably be more intellectual. And that people, you say socialist, and you're almost in McCarthyite territory. People just lose their marbles. Same with tort reform. It gets very, very divisive. And it's almost impossible to have a discussion on this anymore. And part of, I think, what needs to be done is for people to actually know what, for example, tort reform is. It's a great word. It's a great term. But how many people actually really know what tort reform is, what it actually does, who it protects, who it benefits, who it damages? I think people don't know. And that's for a state which prides itself on people understanding economics and finance is a very, very worrying trend.
Well, I think it's also, with the American context, tort reform is based kind of on common law. Whereas in Europe, we have civil law, where you have much more discrete notions of damage and responsibility. And in tort reform here in the United States, when you do away with the ability to do tort law and you don't create alternatives, then there is not even getting towards a civil law. There is no remedy. And people are actively, or have been actively, just disenfranchising themselves.
Okay, so we have trouble in this country comprehending the basic concepts to a great extent. It would seem to me we have an extremely uninformed populace and an uninvolved populace. And I think, Richard, you, having some background in England and in Europe, would probably have a different experience in terms of the basic knowledge of people in society, the basic comprehension of what's going on out there and what the questions are.
Well, I think it's one of these great American myths that everybody in Europe is much more informed about a whole host of issues.
Oh, it's not really, even there?
But I think the difference is that in Europe, the approach is much more, we don't think we do. And there's this general pall of concern, which I think turns into oversight. That there is this question of, we don't know what you're doing, we don't quite trust what you're doing, economic policy is complex, we want it explained, we want it to pay off. And if it doesn't pay off, change the policy. And it's less like an act of devotion, I think, is the way forward. And tax rates get cut in Europe all the time. They get raised. It's not this perpetual take everything out of somebody's back pocket image that is perpetrated on people.
Is that a function, perhaps, maybe then, of not actually knowing more, but of knowing that you don't know more?
I'm going to go with yes on that. I think that's a really, really powerful factor of it. And I think the union background in the UK and across Europe is a strong component of that, because we, at some point in the 19th century, people went, well, you know, you actually do have to rein the worst excesses of the free market in. I know it's heresy. But at the same time, you have, and these things come hand in hand, you have the union saying, you know, pay people for what they're actually worth. You have major charitable trusts like the Roundtree Foundation saying things like, you know what, you can't sell somebody a pound of flour and it's actually half brick dust. That this oversight of the economy and the engines of business go hand in hand.
Well, is that partly because people understand what their interests are and understand who represents different interests, and they actually work based upon those on that?
Well, I think also in part it's that you reach a point where there is such popular kickback that the powers in charge at some point go, well, hang on, the next step is for us to be either in prison or, you know, in early days to be taken out and, and face the mob. And it's a lot of it is reaction based on self-interest and kind of running ahead of the mob before they, you know, and saying, look, we've changed. And that's the problem, is they're making sure that reform is actually real and that changes are real as opposed to superficial. And part of that comes back to, you have to understand what the argument is before you can say, okay, have we answered any of the questions? And that's where understanding the terminology and some, you know, basic economic philosophy, basic political philosophy comes into it.
I think that certainly my sense from being over here looking over across the ocean is that the Europeans have a much more sophisticated sense of economic and political philosophy than we do. But I wouldn't say, and that's a place we need to start. But I don't know that they have, I think that the United States has gotten to be the lead player in the world in our economic system over the last 10, 20 years. And I think the Europeans are coming down with us. So I don't think that that's necessarily been a benefit to them. I think also the Europeans, although have really seen some, with World War I and World War II, the real downside of not being popularly engaged. I think that looking at where we need to go in terms of political philosophies, it would be, it's just like you were saying, that we have these knee-jerk reactions that we go to in politics, and you don't get to this new world that we want to go to by having long dialogues about what's wrong with you for having your belief. We need to just change things so we have a different structure and start knowing a dialogue with each other. So that's really what we need to be trying to find.
Do we need to, by the way, I'm Thorne Dreyer, this is RAG Radio, when we're talking with Tim Mahoney and Richard Whitaker about economics and trying to bring it down to the root level. In fact, we'll talk about the root question, and especially if we talk about things like socialism and capitalism in a minute, and how we address the problems we're facing in society, maybe that we don't play around the edges, but we need to deal with the root causes a little more. I think we were talking about that before. But you've been an observer, Tim, of, as you have pointed out, an observer of the political world in Austin and in this country for a long time. Why are we so removed from any real understanding of what's going on around us in the economic sphere?
Well,
and especially in Texas.
Has anybody ever said that you'd throw out tough questions? I think that, you know, if you look at, you know, to be a leader in this culture is a double-edged sword. You know, what degree are you the biggest bully in town so that you can maintain this position of authority over the masses? Or to what degree are you a collaborator helping to organize people to find their own interests? That's always been a continuum, I think. But I think, you know, coming off the last 8 or 10 years, we're much more into the bully phrase, phase. And I don't think people are necessarily conscious about that. And I think unconsciously, many leaders are American leaders, probably world leaders, are afraid right now of where we're going and how the population is going to react to the reality we're coming into. I try to be really sympathetic towards the people that are leaders. But it's really the only way we're going to be successful is the degree to which we look at the mass disenfranchised as their own kind of leaders. Did that kind of get at your question?
Yeah, I reckon so. Richard, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, this question of people feeling politically disenfranchised, I mean, it part of the problem for us in the media is how do we get past that? Because if our job in the media is to inform people, then if people aren't listening, if people don't read, if they don't actually check on political news, how do you get them back into the fold? While they're still making decisions, while they're still being told certain things that get through as bullet points. For example, with the stimulus money in Texas, the governor's office did an extraordinarily good job of convincing people that, well, A, they didn't take any stimulus money, not true. B, that the stimulus money that they did take was all very, very, very principled, and they rejected a bunch of stuff that was just going to put a greater burden on Texas businesses. Well, not true, but they've done a fantastic job of that, and you're kind of fighting back against an administration that's very, very media aware, very, very media savvy, and gets out ahead of the curve, and it often seems to go unquestioned.
Does the media let itself get played too much?
I think they're too involved in the ground game. I think there is a lot of he said, she said. It's a real problem. And part of it is driven by the fact that, you know, so many news agencies these days and so many papers are so overstretched that all they can do is go, okay, what's in the intro? And you're working from a lot of press releases, and sometimes you just go, well, okay, here's the press release. We're going to move fast. Let's get the response to the press release. And it doesn't matter how crazy the press release is. You know, the person who got there first sets the agenda. Well, if you've got the governor's office or you're a congressman, it's very, very easy to get your blast out first.
Okay. It's 2:20, 2:19, almost 2:20. This is Rag Radio. I'm Thorne Dreyer. Tracy Schultz is my engineer today, talking with Tim Mahoney and Richard Whitaker. We'll be back in just a minute. Thorne Dreyer, this is Rag Radio, and my guests today are Tim Mahoney and Richard Whitaker. Richard, you told me before, you said you had a background in medieval history, and that medieval history was all about politics, taxes, warfare, and architecture. have things changed? And is that still what it's all about? And do we need to learn from that fact?
I mean, those are the basics. I think pretty much so. I mean, it's evolved a little bit. The interests of any crown, any governing body, any duchy, any principality for the longest time was, well, how do we build enough infrastructure to keep ourselves stable, secure, and healthy? But in the Middle Ages, the definition of healthy was, well, how do we stop a neighboring principality coming through and killing everybody here? I think, moved beyond that. But the core issues are the same, and the taxation thing is, well, how do you keep this going? And talking about medieval history, a lot of people probably know about the myth of Robin Hood and the idea that King Richard was off in the Holy Land fighting the good fight, and bad King John was back in Britain raising taxes. Well, the reality was, Richard was off in the Holy Land and occasionally in Greece or anywhere he felt like it, waging war, and he left his brother John in charge to pay for everything. So John became the bad guy because he went, well, okay, I'm being left in charge and my brother is a maniac who's rampaging across most of Europe. Yeah. How do I pay for this? Who gets the bad reputation? The guy who goes off, you know, invading Malta for no good reason because he wants to marry somebody's daughter, or the guy who raises the taxes? The guy who raises the taxes. So, so that part has never changed.
Okay. Well, I think also, just to take off on the medieval metaphor, I think the idea of the Lord has diversified from, it's still a very hierarchical structure in our culture. It's not based so much on land as much as it is resources or who and how we use resources. And that is one of the reasons that we need to be concerned, because that has already changed. And it's going to be more manifest here in the near, you know, next year or so.
Definitely want to get back to resources, because that's clearly critical, and the relationship to the economy is absolutely integral. But one thing I did want to ask, though, is that as society has evolved from medieval times, one of the things that's happened is that government has grown. Back then, government was richer. And I mean, government was very, you could see it, it move, you could see the parts of it, and it was the guys who came around with the, you know, with their swords telling you to pay your taxes, whatever. Now government has gotten so big and so removed and abstract, and people don't know how to relate to it, and especially in this culture, in this society, for many people, it has in and of itself become the enemy. And we see the rise right now of right-wing populism, of people who just are afraid of anything that smacks of central control, and have no kind, and people talking about socialism in crazy ways, socio-fascist.
Very reactionary, knee-jerk kind of.
Yeah. Right. So I guess how, and because of that, people are afraid of taxes, of any kind of taxes. People are afraid of any kind of government operations, and thus they see all of that as socialism, are afraid of that. How do we overcome that? How do we get people to, I mean, what's the role now of centralized government, and how do we have some kind of an organic relationship with it?
Well, I think that's what you have to do. You have to have an organic relationship with it. You know, I was always mystified. I grew up into the mid-70s with a very middle-class kind of nihilistic political view. You know, I mean, I was connected to nothing. And I slowly started seeing that there was people out there. But the story I wrote, one of the stories I wrote for the Texas Observer in the mid-70s was about bank holding companies. And when I went and first saw Jim Hightower, he said, yes, they're unconstitutional. And I went, okay, and what does that mean? And after 6 months worth of research, came back, and they were definitely a violation of the branch banking ban, but there was no, what is the remedy for being in violation? I tell you, I was most amazed that somebody in our culture had the wherewithal to impose on the larger culture their preferred business practices. And that's where we've been forever. You know, and so it's kind of, how do we go from here, understanding that you can't be against government, because in the good world, we are government. And we just need to get that collaboration, that connectedness, so that we have control. Having a centralized government is something to be very concerned about. But having local and community governments is something we really don't have that are really empowered.
If we're going to, obviously, corporate, the free market capitalism, the free market economy has gone absolutely crazy, with no regulation, virtually no regulation, and yet, especially the sort of new populist elements out there say, well, that is somehow freedom. See that, and yet that's bigger than government. You know, that's bigger and more removed from people and more removed from control.
Well, this is part of the dialogue that we need to have, because I forget what law it was. It was in the 20s or the 1880s. That said that corporations were persons under the Constitution. And, I mean, that just needs to change, because it creates an unfair dominance. And I think I saw a TV, dialogue between, who's the guy who wrote, Sicko, produced Sicko?
Michael Moore.
But, yeah, and, the fellow who ran for president from, who's, MD, south of
Ron
Houston.
Paul.
Ron Paul. And they were on the same page, except for when Michael Moore was saying anti-corporatism Ron Paul would give it another term, or maybe I've got it vice versa. So it's really to start looking. We've got all the local populations divided up into small cells that we let be against each other. And we need to find common cause.
Richard, how about the question of how people can understand, can be made to understand that we need to rein in our runaway system?
Well, I think there's a lot of very, very simple metrics that one can use to talk about this. I mean, the fact is that not only are there more poor people than there have been pretty much in American history, but the disparity between the rich and the poor gets bigger and bigger every year. At the same time, the low-end average income drops. Now, the whole thing of saying, well, the free market is intended to, you know, raise everybody simply hasn't worked. And you can prove it by saying, well, okay, look at the number of people who can't afford a regular meal. Food insecurity in this country is going up. That is a simple fact of life.
And that's rationally based.
Yeah.
And look at the people who give themselves $30 million bonuses.
Yeah.
And contrast.
Well, let's don't get diverted from food insecurity.
I think part of it is you have to get it to the point where you can divide, for a reasoned discussion, you have to divide up the people who say, okay, the free market works, it is helping everybody, from the ones who say, the free market is inherently good, and if you die under the free market because you can't afford medical care, because you can't afford food, it's your own fault. You weren't strong enough. And that is out there as a discussion. And I think a lot of the people who just think the free market is the way that we should go because it's the most humane way have very little in common with those devil-take-the-hindmost types who are out there. And, you know, blocking them all together as free marketeers is as toxic and as dangerous and as damaging to any kind of conversation as putting everybody goes, you know what, I don't mind paying my taxes because it's going to keep the roads open. Blocking them and Maoists together as communists. I mean, it's a crazy, crazy approach to finding any kind of middle ground. Now, am I saying that when you get that discussion going, that what you should end up with is something in the middle between those two extremes? Well, no. That's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is starting the discussion, and if at the end of it we all come out somewhere where there's a new consensus, wherever on that spectrum it is, that's what the end game should be, not saying how do we work to...
in the middle.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Right, and I think when you're looking off the precipice, you know, it's a long drop. It may not be an observation you want to make to the crowd behind you. You could be the first to go. I think that we really need to be much more attuned to knowing that none of us has a blueprint for the future. And the changes that we need to find are going to be experiential, people acting together to find. And so that's what I try to do, is try to get people interacting in small enough groups and connected to the larger picture so they can see the change that they make, understand the change that they're going to make, and then when they don't get the results that they want, they can remember what they originally wanted to do. And we don't have any of that going in our culture. It's just really people, as they get more and more concerned. One of my observations is there's a lot of things about the old economic system that I'm going to be glad to see go, but at least it could feed most of us. And that is something that has me concerned, that we need to come together, you know, with things like alternative agriculture and the community farms that many of us are buying into, to get that to be a part of our future. That is part of the dialogue we need to be having.
It's interesting, though, that's a positive thing, but then we also have to look at the factory farming and the things that are controlled that have incredible power, and we have to, at the same time as we're building counter-institutions, don't we have to confront those institutions? Do you think that we could change them merely by building something different?
The part of the consumerist culture that we've become, that those populists we're so afraid of, It's not buying stuff that's cheaper. It's buying stuff that's better. And it, you know, if you ended up with the most efficient economy for capital, none of us would be working. But that, of course, would be suicidal for capital. And, of course, that is what we are currently into. It's that capital has been controlling our destiny for, you know, years. And we've been exporting jobs overseas. I mean, that is democratically, with a small d, suicidal. We have to take responsibility for the mess we're in, as well as all those bugbears that have been out there.
And I think this comes back to this question of the role of government. And the way it's been portrayed, particularly in the States, is saying the role of government is to work out how to spend money. Well, no, that's not its role. Its role is to reflect the popular view of what the standards should be, of what a culture and a civilization should have, and say, okay, what do we need to do to get there? And there is going to be an element of government that does spend money. That's absolutely true. But you also have things like, I mean, we're talking, to go back to food, there is a consensus increasingly that there is a benefit, whether it actually be health related or just in the process of food production, for organic food. Well, a lot of firms have gone, great, let's be involved in the organic market. But now what you're having is a situation where a food product can be classified as organic if it's 90% organic or 85% organic. Well, you know, selling the standard out and keeping the word, it doesn't help anybody. You actually have to enforce the standard. And it's that enforcement role and saying what those standards are that government has to do. And I think if you that basic shift in this discussion of saying, getting people to say, well, what does government do? Rather than just saying, oh, it's the people who take my money and then, you know, build half a highway that never goes anywhere. You know, I think we've got to, you know, if you get them back to their core job of setting the standards, then they're going to spend money better.
Well, I think it's also a matter of us in the hinterlands, in the community, in the neighborhoods, have an efficient way of knowing who's telling us the truth. And you don't have to have standards if you know the person that you're buying fruits and vegetables from is another person like you and wouldn't put poisons on your food or rob it of nutrients any more than they would members of their own family. I mean, these are really simple principles. And that's what has to be the goal that we keep striving for as we get to the changes that need to come. You know, you were making some comment about the governor. You know, we have the vast majority of us have no way to know who's lying to us when. And the fact of the matter is that probably most of the information that we get in our lives are lies. And how can you and I think most of us know it. And how do you what we end up doing is having a mass psychology where people are going, I'm a failure, rather than the system is a failure. And how do we bridge those two differences in the future?
Well, you know, we pay such lip service to democracy, to the concept of democracy, and in many ways we're not a very democratic society. Unless we see democracy as being something that happens every election. There's so little, and unless we see democracy as being something that also involves the economy. Which gets us back to the question of how those sort of larger definitions, those ideological definitions, for instance, socialism, which in fact is designed as a way of democratizing the economy, is it not? And if we could talk to people about economic democracy as opposed to talking to people about socialism, maybe that kind of thing could help. If we could help if people could understand that.
Well, I think also socialism has grown up in the context of capitalism running amok. One of the things I've discovered since I ceased being a middle class kid trying to figure out what the world was about, is there is actually a philosophy that describes my political orientation besides populism, because I personally like developing issues through the population. But it's called communitarianism. Mm-hmm. And all of these, you know, where you have communities that are empowered, how do you get there? And everybody at all tiers of our culture, from the chambers of commerce to radical people in the hinterlands, use the word community, but none of them define it. And it's because it's some notion that we have, but it can be a, it needs to be a very real and tangible thing. In my worldview of the future, we have engaged individuals who are able to promote their own efforts to get satisfaction for themselves and their families. But, you know, this book that came out recently, Deep Economy, it says that anything we equate having more with being happier. And he finds that that's true up until about $10,000 a year. And after that, there's no net gain. So it's really, what is it that we find happiness? I think it's having barbecues with people around the church and not being able to make it so that people can't have barbecues, which is, I think, where our culture's been going.
It's very, I think it's significant and very important that we look on the local level and look on the community level, and that we do things like, as you say, if we know the person we're buying the food from, then that creates an organic relationship, literally and figuratively. But there's a lot of stuff that happens that really can't happen on that kind of one-on-one level. And so we have to go beyond that, but don't we have to do more?
Well, that's in the world that we're transitioning to. That's the danger, because right now most of us don't trust anybody. And there's a real good reason for that. But we have to, we can't have good, in quotes, politics without it being based in some way on trust. And so we have to find the way that we do that. And I've seen people on the left and right, when somebody's trying to have a dialogue and the person they're talking to switches their response to go much more global and to categorize the person as an idiot, as stupid. And that is just not productive. That's not the kind of dialogue that we have, that we need to have.
Using the term global is... brings me to another question, and it's a certainly related question, because we're going from the local to so much of what we have to deal with is controlled now on a global level. And how much has what we call globalization and the questions of free trade and whatever, how much has that affected what we do? How much can we change things without changing that?
Well, a lot of globalization has been based around one thing. Let's get something very core here. Global trade has been powered by cheap fuel.
Right.
Nothing more, nothing less. That's what allowed it to happen. The fact that you can now not simply grow an apple in New Zealand and import it to the US, but keep the refrigerator unit churning for a year to keep it good and then sell it at a reasonable price. Not at the kind of price that, you know, in the 19th century when you ship a pomegranate to the UK from North Africa.
You know, cheaper than you could get it from Washington State.
Yeah. That is solely about fuel. And, you know, Tim's been talking a lot about the long-term sustainability of the economy. As fuel prices go up, which they will, the entire oil industry now accepts that that we've reached peak oil. The production is not going to get any better than this. Prices will only go up. And it's not going to be a seasonal up in the winter, you know, down in the summer, whichever way you want to look at it. This is just going to happen. Prices are going to go up unless you stop importing so much. And the problem of the cheap importation has meant that America has been sending money overseas and reached a point where it went, well, hang on, we need to get some money from somewhere, and started borrowing from overseas.
China.
Yeah. Well, China now is in this position where people think, you know, oh, well, you know, China's holding the purse strings. Well, China's now looking at America and going, Can we have some of our money back, please? America owns China more than China owns America in a lot of ways. And when cheap Chinese imports are not cheap anymore, then they're going to be in as much trouble, possibly more trouble, than we're in at the moment.
Okay, my guests, I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is Rag Radio. My guests are Richard Whitaker, who writes on Texas politics and education for the Austin Chronicle, and Tim Mahoney, who is a trustee at the Austin Community College. We'll be back in just a minute.
had to look, having read the
Rag Radio. I'm Thorne Dreyer. My engineer is Tracy Schultz, and my guests are Tim Mahoney and Richard Whitaker. We talked about globalization and the role that that plays and how that takes things away in many ways from the local level and from local control, from our being able to feel empowered. We talk about the economy, and the economy is kind of our topic here, although it's everything's interrelated, right? What about the role of war? You know, we talk about, I mean, everybody freaks out about how much health care is going to cost, but war has always just been off, the costs of war have been off the table. Nobody's even taken that into account. I mean, if we, without the Iraq war, a bogus war in the first place, which everyone acknowledges now, think of what could have been done.
Well, as my editor, Michael King at the Austin Chronicle, always says, you can sum up contemporary spending policy as wars are free, everything is just too expensive, and we just can't even bother discussing the cost.
Yeah, the recent decision that Obama's trying to go through with where he's going to be going with Afghanistan, I heard that one of the considerations he's trying to deal with is cost. That if he puts 40,000 more troops in there, it's going to cost like $50 billion a year. And he ought to, you know, it's so great having a smart guy who's president. And the what he's been given to deal with, I mean, I don't think history is going to be necessarily kind to him up to this point about how he's balanced things. You know, I'm amazed with his political skills at pumping in the stimulus money that he did so that we ended our recession and had a 3% bump last quarter. But that is not sustainable. That's going to cause inflation, and that's really going to have everything come home to roost. And so I think he's, by the public murmurings that I get out of the decision with the Afghanistan decisions, I think he's becoming aware of that. And, of course, all the economic architects that he has around him are people from the Clinton administration who really set up the stuff for the Bush administration.
Well, you want to talk about the recovery, incidentally, and you say that it's amazing the bump that they've gotten, but what does that mean if there's no employment? I mean, what kind of a recovery is that?
Well, I think it's something that we in a democracy should not stand for, that this is no longer the time to be cultivating the health of capital. If we don't have jobs, we need to understand why and how we get them. I don't think there's ever going to be jobs again like we've had before. What we need to start thinking is how can we collaborate together so that we can create local economies and let our families eat. I mean, we need to go through some pretty subtle and huge shifts in our political and economic outlooks.
I think looking at, you know, one of the things that's happening at the moment is obviously the healthcare debate, where people are actually talking about how much this is going to cost, and numbers get thrown around left, right, and center. But the most interesting thing for me about this, and I think the most worrying thing in a lot of ways about, which shows, I think, where the power relationship lies, is that the drug companies are saying, well, we're going to put prices up on a lot of our non-generics.
They already did.
Yeah. Let's be honest, it's called price fixing. This is market manipulation, and it's so blatant.
I think they have an exemption from antitrust laws to do that kind of thing. And of course, if we had power, that would not be tolerated. But that's one of the things that Obama has to deal with, is that we don't have power. And so I'm almost for anything that gets through, as long as it starts cultivating awareness that it should be political policy in the United States that we have a healthy communities. You know, evidently that's not public policy right now.
Well, the problem is that there's no coordinated controls. And so you can do stuff, and there were stuff that was done in the recovery, in the supposed stimulus plan, but it was all narrowly defined, and so the corporate crazies out there were still able to work around that and profit from the fix. You know, the supposed fix ends up creating more problems.
I think that the controls that Obama put on the stimulus package was a lot better than what Bush put out last fall, which I think just money just went out. It was a big black hole, and we're never going to know how that money was used. So, and you know, it's the existing power structure. You know, part of the thing that we've gone through is more of us are becoming aware of what that power structure is. It should not be tolerated anymore, but we have to know what it is before we can do that. And we also have to have economies of scale for us, the great unwashed, to be able to plug into to come up with alternatives. You don't kill off the lord of the manor. You have to wait till Robin Hood comes in so you can replace him.
And hope that Robin Hood isn't a fraud like Richard suggested he really was.
That's right. You need to be able to have some sense of efficient truth-telling.
Yes.
So it becomes a part of our community vocabulary, which it isn't.
Okay, when we bring the economy home to the individual, people in this society can't do much without credit. Credit is kind of at the core of everything. And when credit and finance has been controlled by, I don't like to use the term monsters because that has sort of a value judgment implicit in it, but how do we rein that in, and isn't that key to getting everything under control?
I think the problem with reining in credit, which has to be done, America cannot sustain any really workable economy without changing its attitude towards credit. And just to go to a European experience, and just to give you guys a little bit of context on this, before coming over here, I'd never heard of the concept of a payday loan. The idea that a business, for example, will once a month go to the bank and say, okay, I need to pay my wages this month. Let's sort out this really fast line of credit. And, you know, it'll get paid off in a few days. But this whole idea that you go in and out of debt so regularly and so erratically, it's just baffling to me. I mean, in the UK, you would either set up a major long-term agreement and say, okay, well, this is our plan. This is how we're going to do it. Or you just don't go into debt like that. And if you do, your bank will call you up and say, what on earth do you think you're doing? It's a very, very different process. And the credit is so easy, so consistent, so much of a backbone of the American economic system means that over time, credit has got looser and looser and looser. And everybody looked at the mortgages, where you have people walking in and they're being given a mortgage worth 10 times their annual salary. Well, you go back 30 years, if you could get 2.5 times your annual salary of your single highest wage earner in the household, you were doing really, really well. You were considered a good credit risk. Now you can walk in and, you know, you're making $30,000 a year and somehow you're on the receiving end of a $300,000 mortgage. That's not sustainable. And that you've gone to the point where that is an argument, where that is possible. You have to go, how did we get here? And I still think that people aren't realizing the way it was people just went, credit's essential. And now you don't even discuss it. You say, well, how do we trim back on credit? Rather than saying, well, how do we really want to have a system that is so totally built around easy, affordable, long-term credit, in and out, in and out, in and out of debt?
Well, I've heard people say, you know, get rid of your major credit cards and just keep your ones with the credit union. Because there are elements in our culture, our economic culture, that still have kind of a fair trade attitude towards their consumers, their customers, the people who own them. And, you know, I think that you look at, I've talked to people from Peru who said that the major difference between their economy and the American, this of course was, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, was they couldn't have access to credit cards, that they could call up someone in a city 400 miles away and say, I'm sending this to you, how are you going to pay for it? And we just say, here's a credit card. And so I think that kind of thing might be still useful to maintain. But right, I think we have, you know, really the ease of credit is what led to the secondary security markets and fraudulent mortgages. There were people who were making money on that all down the line, but it was based on people said, you don't understand it, and because it made no sense. And that is part of the thing that's still lingering out there, how that will come down. You know, I think American real estate has in fact, already fallen by 50%. But we haven't been trying to sell it for hope. The stock market, you know, I think that's driven by psychology. How do we get it so, you know, how we get through the short term where we've had just an unhealthy psychology to this time where we're more balanced? That's a pretty mean trick.
Tim and Richard, we're running down to our last few minutes here, so I'm going to throw two things out, which we won't have time to deal with, of course. And one is, what do you see happening right now with the economy? I mean, do you think we're really out of the woods, or are we facing, because there's a lot of other factors, including the ecology and all kinds of things that are coming into play. Do you think that we're facing calamity? And then the other question is, what do you think we can do? What can people listening do? How do we do something about all of this?
Well, when it comes to the economy, I think that people are looking and go, well, the roof's not on fire at the moment, but they need to look in the basement. And that's where the global problem still is. And I think particularly in Texas, the consensus now seems to be not that we are out of the woods, but that we're several steps behind the rest of the party, and that a lot of other states, which looked worse 6 months ago, are going to be getting free and clear faster than we are. In part, it's because the jobs that were hit first were manufacturing jobs, and Texas does not have a big manufacturing industry anymore. So when those jobs start coming back, the industries here, which benefited from them existing, are going to take a while for that to trickle down and start having an impact. So things could get a lot worse in Texas before they get better. And as several people have pointed out, they weren't that great to begin with. Yeah, when we had the worst food insecurity, the worst child health coverage, if we just get back to where we were 3 years ago, there is a long way to go to modernizing the Texas economy.
Well, don't we have to just really change our priorities, and is that going to happen?
Well, we have to have a way to find our priorities that's being made by us and not by the governor's office. I think we're going through a structural change. And I think it was Mark Twain who said, you can't have an economy without making stuff. Not everybody can be taking in laundry. You can't be just a service economy. And so, you know, we've had this idea that we're an information economy and stuff, which is, you know, I think it's pretty bogus because we just ship off real meaningful labor to other places. But the market, they're going to be hurting too because they're not going to be buying from us. I think we've got some real serious unresolved problems coming down the pike. And it's kind of like, what can we do? Somebody was asking me that the other day, whose son was, has had a history with drugs and alcohol. And I said, well, I could tell you what you could do, but that wouldn't help you because it takes a lot of little changes in order to find a better path. And ultimately, it's not just what you do. It's what you do in consultation with your neighbors.
And is there something, as a member, as a representative of the media here, Richard, is there something that the media can be doing to help sort of define terms a little better?
I think actually having the spine to not just report exactly what is handed down to them, which is the same old thing that we're supposed to be doing. And that I think where the media is, that's a question for another day. But
yes.
You can't just say, well, look at the number of headlines where they say such and such says X, such and such says Y. Why isn't there the next line, actually Z is true? And have a little bit of a spine to say, by the way, all parties may be wrong on this. if you're going to be out in the media, once in a while, you've got to put a couple of kicks in yourself.
Every once in a while, they ought to tell the truth, don't you think?
You think. Okay, thank you very much. Tim Mahoney, Richard Whitaker. Tim Mahoney is a trustee at Austin Community College. Richard Whitaker is a reporter, a writer for the Austin Chronicle. I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is Rag Radio. This has been Rag Radio. We come your way every Tuesday at 2, and please join us every week. And if you know other people who are not in the listening area who'd like to listen, just go to the KOOP website, and you can find out how to stream it. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Certainly enjoyed it.
Thank you very much indeed.
call me mama. If you